You're listening to DTFHN for March 26, 2026. I'm your losslessly compressed host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where you pangin' you a patient with hop fixes. WDAC, ER, argument, patient, layered already there. If you knew where to look, let's get into it. The strongest case against this project is also the most honest one. Private photos, family stories, oral histories. These are intimate records. Feed them into a corporate language model, and you have handed an unknown number of training pipelines a window into your family's private life. One commenter made this point directly. It is not paranoia. It is a reasonable inference from how these systems work. And yet, in 1935, Vannevar Bush published As We May Think in the Atlantic. He described a device he called the Memex. A mechanized personal archive where a person could store their books, records, and communications, and retrieve any of it instantly, with trails of association linking one piece to the next. He wrote it as speculation. What he was actually describing was the internet, hypertext, and the personal knowledge management systems that wouldn't exist for another 50 years. Bush's insight wasn't about the technology, it was about the nature of memory and loss. He watched the Second World War generate an overwhelming volume of human knowledge, and he understood that most of it would vanish. Not because it wasn't recorded, but because the recordings couldn't talk to each other. What this person built in two evenings is structurally, the Memex, physical photographs linked to oral history, linked to EXIF metadata, linked to Wikipedia articles providing wider context. The person who sang at a grandparent's wedding, discovered decades later to be the nurse who delivered the grandchild. That connection only becomes visible when the data can reference itself. The privacy concern is real and worth taking seriously. Particularly the point about local infrastructure. Run this on your own hardware with a model you control, and the calculus changes completely. The tools exist. A local instance of MediaWiki is free software. Openweight models run on consumer GPUs. The architecture the article describes is fully replicable, without corporate data pipelines anywhere near it. What's striking is how simple the core insight is. The encyclopedia format, the info box, the linked stubs, the citation, wasn't designed for family history. It was designed for encyclopedias. But the structure turns out to be exactly right for this problem. Named entities, linked references, verifiable dates, media with captions, information that can point to other information. Bush called his device the Memex because it was meant to extend memory. 80 years later, someone cloned MediaWiki and did it. Memory becomes infrastructure. And speaking of infrastructure built to last, Swift 6.3 just dropped something worth celebrating. When Apple says Swift is designed for every layer of the software stack, what does that actually mean? Not rhetorical. What do they mean by every? Swift shipped in 2014 as the language for apps that run on Apple hardware, sold through Apple Store on Apple's operating system. That's a layer, sure, a very specific layer. The layer that generates the most margin in computing history. Now take that claim to its logical conclusion. Every layer. Embedded firmware. Internet scale services. Android. Swift Loopoint Thrice ships an official SDK for Android. That's not nothing. That's Apple's language running on Google's platform. The two largest mobile ecosystems, sharing a language. Follow the every layer principle, honestly, and you end up here. Which means either the principle was always genuine, or the principle became genuine because the alternative was watching Rust and Go colonize every domain Swift couldn't reach. The technical substance of this release is real. the C attribute is elegant. Annotate a Swift function, get a valid C declaration in the generated header, interop in both directions. Cross-language calling without ceremony. That's the kind of plumbing that lets Swift reach down into legacy codebases instead of requiring a full rewrite. The new module selector. Specifying exactly which module's function you want when two modules collide on the same name are minor but correct, the kind of obvious fix you're surprised took this long. The comments are doing what HN comments do. Someone notes they haven't touched Swift since version 3 around 2015 to 2017, when it could have easily dethroned Python. That window is closed. Python won the data science and AI era not because it was better designed. It wasn't. But because it was already there, and being there is most of the game. What's genuinely interesting is the shape of Swift's ambition in 6.3. Not apps, not frameworks. The embedded environment improvements, the build tooling unification, the Android SDK. This is a language trying to escape the gravitational pull of the platform that created it. Whether it succeeds depends on something no release note can fix. Whether developers outside the Apple ecosystem see Swift as a tool that belongs to them. Languages aren't just syntax and runtime. They're communities. They're who shows up in the forum at 2 a.m. to help you debug the thing that doesn't make sense. Swift is good enough. The question is whether good enough is enough. Story 3 is pure show HN energy. Someone built a thing, made it open, and dropped it here. Exactly the kind of story that makes this show worth making. There's a specific failure mode I've encountered building layered systems. You're deep in a pipeline. Tool calls stacking on tool calls, each abstraction hiding the one beneath it. And you lose track of where the actual work is happening. The abstraction was supposed to clarify. Instead, it diffuses responsibility across a stack nobody fully owns. Relay is an Electron desktop app from 17 Labs that positions itself as the control plane for OpenClaw. Governance, approval gates, audit trails, cost tracking, connector management. OpenClaw handles execution. Relay handles oversight. The pitch is aimed squarely at regulated industries that need Claude Cowork's workflow pattern, but can't route sensitive data through Anthropic's servers. Data sovereignty, model flexibility, compliance audit trails. Real problems. The solution is architecturally clean. Separate what you see and configure from what actually runs. The question nobody is asking is, when you add a governance layer to an autonomous system, who is actually responsible for the decisions it makes? This is the comedy of unintended consequences playing out in real time. One HN commenter did the math. This is a wrapper on a wrapper on Claude code, which is already a wrapper on the API. They're not wrong. Another pointed out that the red meat. Dense within dashes, ASCII diagrams, and feature squares. Reads like it was authored by the thing it wraps. Also not wrong. A third asked why AI slop ranks so high on Hacker News. The recursion here is essentially perfect. None of this invalidates the actual value proposition. Companies genuinely cannot send regulated data to external VMs. Model lock-in genuinely matters when you have custom inference endpoints, cost constraints, or workflows that Anthropic's infrastructure doesn't accommodate. Compliance gaps in audit logging are a real blocker in financial services and healthcare. These are not manufactured problems, but add a governance layer to something that makes autonomous decisions, and the approval gate becomes theater unless the person clicking through it actually understands what they're approving. The audit trail is excellent documentation. The question is whether anyone reads it. Run this forward. The architecture is sound, the abstraction is useful, and the problem it solves is real. The softer question. Building oversight tools assumes the overseer has enough context to oversee. That one doesn't go away just because you can export the logs. That question hangs over every control plane, not just this one. What do you actually lose when a sound disappears? Story 4 has an answer worth hearing. IBM mainframe engineers in the 1960s used to diagnose problems by listening. The magnetic drums, the core memory access patterns, the cooling system. Each component had a signature. An experienced operator could hear a bad sector forming before any diagnostic tool caught it. The machine spoke, and the people who knew how to listen could understand what it was saying. That knowledge is gone now. Not archived, not documented. Just gone, with the people who held it. This is a specific loss that Obsolete Sounds is trying to reckon with. The project, From Cities in Memory, Archives Disappearing Soundscape. From the 56K modem handshake to the ambience of urban environments redeveloped past recognition. And pairs each archived sound with an artist's recomposition. The combination is methodologically smart. Strip it to first principles. What makes a sound worth preserving? A photograph can be printed, rescanned, reproduced. A sound is definitionally temporal. It exists in time and then doesn't. You can record it, but the recording is a translation. The waveform is not the sound. It's a representation, and when the cultural context dissolves, when no one remembers what that room felt like, what it meant to sit at that terminal as it negotiated a connection in frequencies humans weren't designed to hear, the translation loses its referent. The 50K modem handshake is the clearest example. Listen cold, without context, and it's noise. Hear it once with the knowledge that this is two machines figuring out how to talk to each other for the first time. Negotiating speed, encoding, error correction, all in real time, all audible. And it becomes a document. The sound is the protocol made perceptible. That's remarkable engineering, and it's gone. What the contributing artists understand is that archival alone isn't enough. A WAV file of a VHS rewind doesn't capture what that sound meant at 11 p.m. in 1994. You have to transform the material to understand what was actually lost. The recompositions do something the archive can't. They make the loss legible. One commenter said it cleanly. We obsess over images and video, but soundscapes vanish almost unnoticed. The infrastructure for preserving events is harder to build than the infrastructure for preserving objects. We built it late. These people are building it now. Moving on. One comment in the thread sent me down a rabbit hole, the 64-bit transition, where Intel tried to bury the 88-6 architecture entirely with Itanium and failed spectacularly. AMD uses SUR1 instead. That's its own story. But to understand why it happened, you need to understand what came before it. And that means the Pentium and why the Pentium had to exist as a name. Well, here's the devil's advocate position. Intel should have kept licensing. The competitive mess that followed. AMD, Cyrix, NextGen, all making 586 class chips. Was Intel's own doing. If they'd maintained second source agreements, consumers would have had compatible options. Prices would have stayed lower, and the PC revolution would have accelerated cleanly. Watch that argument collapse. The original licensing agreements weren't generous. They were trivia paid to IBM. Big Blue demanded second sources as insurance. No IBM contract, no obligation. When the 386 launched, IBM actively didn't want powerful PCs. They wanted to sell you a mini computer. So Intel said, we're done sharing. What happened next is the actual engineering story. AMD had made 2086 under license. They knew the microcode. They reverse-engineered their way into the 386 market anyway, won a court battle that established cleanroom reverse-engineering as legitimate competitive practice, and spent the next decade building real capability from the ground up. K5, K6, Athlon, Opteron, AMD 64. The 64-bit architecture that won because Intel's Itanium was too alien and AMD's was just the 32-bit world extended logically forward. The licensing arrangement would have kept AMD as a dependent. The competition made them engineers. Pentium itself is a small masterpiece of corporate linguistics under pressure. Intel codenames the 486 successor P5. Courts confirm you can't trademark a number. Someone invents Pentium. From Pen to 5 with a premium suffix. And suddenly you have a brand name that means 5 without being 5. Trademarkable, memorable, and almost immediately stress tested by the FDIV bup. A floating point division error caught by a math professor running prime number calculations. $500 million to replace affected chips, a brand that survived because it was 3 years ahead of meaningful competition. The commenter who remembered writing cyberpunk stories about 7 out of 6 got something right. The naming era was product roadmap as mythology. Each generation sounding like a future that hadn't arrived yet. Moving on. A terabyte of documents. Thousands of files, formats ranging from PDFs and CSVs to OrcaFlex simulation output. Proprietary binary files from offshore engineering projects. One engineer, no prior RAG experience, tasked with making all of it queryable in natural language. This is a clean laboratory for understanding what retrieval augmented generation actually is at the constraint level, not the marketing level. The fundamental problem RAG solves is finite context. Language models cannot hold everything in attention. A terabyte is obviously impossible, but even a few thousand documents exceeds what any model can process at query time, so you need a retrieval layer. A way to find the relevant pages before you ask the question. The book index analogy is accurate, with one critical difference. This index is built from meaning, not keywords. Embeddings are dense numerical representations of semantic content. Similar meaning clusters, near similar meaning in vector space. You embed a query. Find the nearest document chunks. Pass those chunks plus the query to the model. That is RAG. The engineer's first script crashed the laptop by loading every file into memory, including multi-gigabyte simulation outputs, video files, backups. Llama Index didn't know those weren't text. The pipeline needed a filtering layer before it needed anything else. This is a recurring pattern in heterogeneous ingestion systems. The garbage rejection problem often turns out to be harder than the core problem you originally came to solve. The stack they landed on matters. All Llama for local model serving, Gnomic embed text for embeddings, Llama Index for orchestration. Every component open source. That choice wasn't arbitrary. It was load-bearing. Confidential engineering documents from nearly a decade of offshore projects cannot leave the network. That single constraint eliminates every managed API service. The open source ecosystem absorbs that requirement cleanly because the architecture is designed around ownership. You control the model, you control the vectors. You control the retrieval logic. One reader flagged that Chromatopy, mentioned in the article, is open source infrastructure. Not Google's product. Worth correcting because it shifts what the story means. The tools that solve this problem are community built. They exist because engineers decided to build in the open and leave the work where others could reach it. A decade of offshore engineering knowledge, made queryable. The tools existed. Now the documentation of how to use them does too. From tools that surface 10 years of offshore wisdom, Story 7, a toolkit that makes the terminal feel like home again. 47 years ago, Brian Fox wrote a library. In you read line. Line editing machinery. The code that moves your cursor through text, deletes words, searches history. It shipped with Bash. It was released under the GPL. It has been quietly present on your machine, linked into Python, PostgreSQL, the MySQL client, Ruby, Lua, and dozens of other tools. For as long as you've been building things, most people don't know its name. They interact with it thousands of times a day. The article naming these bindings. Control W to delete the previous word, Control plus to cut to the beginning of the line, Control plus to paste back, Alt of and Alt back to jump a word at a time, Control plus to the search history. Is performing a specific kind of service. It's pointing at something that has always been there. The problem is, nobody told you. The author splits the list usefully. Universal tricks that work on any POSIX-ish shell and quality of life edition specific to Bash and ZSH. The former category is the more interesting one. These aren't Bash features. They're terminal line discipline and read line, which means they travel with you. SSH into an embedded router from 2009. Drop into a minimal Alpine container. The bindings follow. This is bootstrapism in its most literal form. These aren't features you acquire. There's no plugin, no paid tier, no managed service to enable. They are already installed. The work was done in 1989, put under the GPL, and has been compounding since. Every engineer who learns control, pawn, draw, instead of holding backspace for 6 seconds, is collecting on a debt someone else paid before most of us were writing code. Fox chose a free license. That choice is why readline is in Python's interactive prompt, in PostgreSQL's PSQL client, in your shell right now. The comments extend the picture. One reader services controller behavior. Press it twice and it autofills with your previous search term. Useful when iterating on the same Docker command in slight variations. Another brings up Vim mode, which replaces readline's Emacs defaults with modal editing. Same infrastructure, different philosophy. There's a commenter who mentions a script named with a single hash character, living in someone's path, used to comment out pipe elements inline. The shell's composability runs that deep if you go looking. The documentation is a blog post. The library is 47 years old. The tools have been there the entire time. What does it say about a tool that outlasts every trend? Or what does it say about an artist when their image outlasts their music? $6,400. 7 days. 29 minutes and 4 seconds of music. Zero chart appearances. And 50 years later, that album cover is hanging in MoMA. Run this forward and it gets stranger. The Ramones never had a hit or a chord. Their singles didn't chart. Their albums didn't chart. By every conventional metric of commercial success in the music industry, they failed. And yet their logo, that presidential seal knockoff with the four names arranged like it was official business, is one of the most recognized images in the history of popular culture. Walk into any city on earth and you'll find the shirt. More people wear it than have ever heard the album it came from. The article frames this as an uncomfortable truth. I'm not sure the discomfort is correctly aimed. The Brian Eno observation fits here too. The people who bought the album started bands. Those bands changed everything. The Ramones sold roughly 500,000 copies of their debut in the first decade. They eventually went platinum. Meanwhile, every grunge act, every pop punk act, every band that ever played three chords fast and meant it owes them a debt they'll never collect. The genuine irony cuts in a different direction. The music industry spent decades measuring success in first week chart positions and album sales. Metrics designed by labels for labels. The Ramones played 2,263 shows. They toured relentlessly on a bus while major labels threw millions at stadium acts. They got paid almost nothing from recording. The t-shirt revenue outlasted the business model that was supposed to sustain them. If that's failure, the industry's definitions need work. Imagine if cultural penetration had always been the metric. Imagine if how many people does this change had been the KPI instead of chart position. The Ramones would have been considered one of the most successful acts in rock history from day one, because by that measure, they were. The commenter who notes that most acts now make more from touring and merch than song sales isn't describing a failure mode. That is the model now. Streaming gutted recorded revenue. The Ramones lived this future accidentally, 40 years early. Joey's credo. Do it from the heart and follow your instincts. The discomfort in the headline is a category error. They weren't trying to sell records. They were trying to make something true. The t-shirts are proof it worked. What happens when someone makes something true and the world finally catches up? Story 9. The strongest case for Kings North goes like this. The symptoms are real. Attention is fragmented. Civic capacity is eroding. The pandemic response demonstrated how quickly pure technique can override human judgment. Contact tracing apps, QR codes, algorithmic enforcement of policy, the careful calibration of which voices got amplified and which got quietly buried. Something is being lost. The slow poison metaphor isn't hysterical. It's precise. We improve when the dose pauses. We worsen when it resumes. Mrs. Pungley is us, and the doctor keeps diagnosing gastritis. But there's an analogy that cracks this argument open. Medieval monasteries were extraordinary preservation institutions. Monks copied manuscripts by hand for centuries with real devotion and enormous care. They were the good guys. By making knowledge something you had to live inside an institution to receive. They made it, inadvertently, a lever. Knowledge as fortress. When the printing press arrived, it didn't threaten the texts. Threatened the false jot. It threatened the walls. What Gutenberg actually did was take the most valuable thing the monasteries held and put it where ordinary people could touch it. The monks experienced this as civilizational catastrophe. Their readers called it liberation. They were both describing the same event. Kings North's critique comes from inside the fortress. He watches the drawbridge lower and reads it as danger. The actual danger is abandoning the field to people who will use the machinery without his scruples. Now the comedy. He wrote this on Substack. The Abbey of Misrule. His newsletter, the source material for this book, exists because engineers built an open publishing platform and gave access to anyone who wanted it. His dissident voice survived 2021 precisely because the decentralized web made him difficult to simply silence. The infrastructure he's warning us about is the infrastructure that kept his warning alive. Run the counterfactual. His manuscript lands at a publisher in 1995, gets declined, sits in a drawer. With the machine, 4 years of essays, a global readership, a book deal. The machine consumed his critique of the machine and distributed at scale. The diagnosis of closed, extractive, attention-harvesting systems is correct and worth your time. The prescription. Retreat! Generalized suspicion! Misidentifies where the poison enters. It's not in the technology. It's in who controls the off switch when it matters. The knife is not the kitchen. Moving on! What happens when the physical form of a book is part of the argument? William T. Volman finished a novel called A Table for Fortune in 2022. 12 to 15 years of research. CIA material. 3,000 pages. his publisher of 30 years. Viking received it, deliberated, and dropped him. The more reasons layer up, the manuscript was enormous. There were uncharacteristic typos, which Volman concedes. His daughter Lisa died that same year, and in the months before, he'd been calling her on a burner phone every day at noon, trying to get her off the street, getting no answer more often than not. He'll grant them the typos. Fine. But there was also the matter of fonts. Open any of Volman's recent work and you feel it as a physical object before you've read a word. Paragraphs that run for pages and then snap to two syllables. Sentences that unspool and cut. Photographs, drawings, charts, typefaces that shift to signal different speakers. Different documents, different registers of memory and evidence. The architecture of the page is not decoration. It's arguments. If you're building something that intricate, the font choices are not cosmetic. The way the text moves is part of what it's saying. A table for fortune requires specific fonts to make that architecture function. Fonts Viking doesn't own, and licensing them, Volman says, would raise the unit cost of each printed copy by 2 cents. 2 cents. And you 19 receive for wand rap. Like, yet use a confrontation no competition, Leguasso. The end, pubil du vaccination fagers, finds all time. The boypings tabics and enlaza. The publishers and enmundling the budasting. The results were, in Newt's view, unacceptable. The precision required for mathematical notation wasn't there. His response, spend the next 10 years building text and metafont from scratch, not to solve a general problem, because he had a specific vision for how his work needed to be realized, and the available infrastructure couldn't meet it. Newt built his way out. Volman's situation runs the other direction. The vision is complete, the craft is exact, the tools exist. And the infrastructure says, not our fonts, 2 cents per unit, we can't. 30 years of partnership, one canceled contract, a possible masterpiece sitting without a publisher because nobody wanted to negotiate a licensing agreement. We imagine gatekeeping as ideological. Sometimes it's a line item nobody budgeted for. The manuscript exists. The blurbs from editors who've glimpsed it are cautious and genuinely excited. What it's waiting for, still, is infrastructure willing to carry it the rest of the way. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 26, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go uncover something that's been waiting for you. We'll see you back here tomorrow.